Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome once again. We come to you 7 days a week to tell you about our world as it is. We always present interesting stories at a slow speed, and we use words that are easy to understand. It's a great way to learn American English. Today we bring you medical news of a special kind from Cambodia. Then we will talk about politics in the United States. There is a town near Washington, D.C., whose leader is only 19 years old. You're going to enjoy this one. It's time to listen and learn with the Voice of America. Cambodia has some of the world's worst mental health statistics. Experts say the large number of cases is partly a result of Khmer Rouge rule in the 1970s. The Cambodian government spends little on mental health services. The World Health Organization says such services are, in its words, critically neglected. Experts do not believe that will change anytime soon, because few Cambodian students are interested in psychiatry as a career. They have little or no interest in the treatment and prevention of mental disorders. Christopher Jones Cruz reports many Cambodians must travel long distances to cities to get help, and the help they get when they arrive is little more than a brief talk and some medicine.
Most Cambodians live in rural areas, but few mental health services are provided there. So people must go to psychiatric centers in cities, like the Khmer Soviet Hospital in Phnom Penh. It is one of the busiest clinics in the country. Yem Subotra is the director of the clinic. He says that 15 years ago, it cared for between 70 and 150 patients every day. When our reporter visited recently, the daily average was 400. The clinic has just 10 psychiatrists and 10 nurses or aides. So most patients are treated for just a few minutes and leave with a bottle of pills. Dr. Yem Subotra knows medicine can help patients, but is not the only answer. He says the clinic could help people more if it had more money and other resources.
So we not much time to give good service for them, especially for psychotherapy. We just only some sort counseling sort psychotherapy to the patient.
In addition to the lack of trained mental health specialists, Cambodia does not have the newer drugs used in neighboring Vietnam and Thailand. Cambodia needs more psychiatrists, but few young people seem interested in the subject. Nationwide, just 6 students are taking the 3-year-long study program. Experts say low pay and the challenges of studying psychiatry keep many Cambodians from wanting to get training. Our reporter repeatedly asked Cambodian officials how many doctors and nurses have been trained in mental health care. But the question was never answered. The Cambodian government spends about $1 million a year on mental health services. That is much less than is needed. So it is not likely that the country's mental health care delivery system will improve anytime soon. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now, Jonathan Evans joins us with the story of a man who has made politics his job, even though he is barely old enough to be called Mr.
Brandon Paulin is the top official in the town of Indian Head, Maryland, even though he is only 19 years old. Mr. Paulin started the job this month. He says his first goal is to bring business back to the town. The area is about 2.5 kilometers wide and sits between two rivers. About 4,000 people live there. It includes small businesses, old homes on tree-lined streets, and new townhouses along the highway. It is about an hour's drive away from the U.S. capital of Washington, D.C. But on the way into the capital, the highway passes the remains of closed businesses. The shops failed largely because of competition from shopping centers in larger cities. Mr. Paulin says when some people drive into Indian Head and see the empty buildings, they just turn around and leave. He hopes to return the town to what it used to be, a friendly, successful place with natural beauty where people want to live and visit. Many, many years ago, Indian Head was a booming town, and that's what I want to get back, he said. I want to entice businesses as much as I can, using business incentives. Right now, the people who own the old, empty buildings are permitted to use their properties to reduce their taxes. Mr. Paulin wants to reverse the situation. He plans to charge owners a fee for empty buildings and to increase the cost every year. That way, he says, owners will hurry to establish a new business. Brian Lyles lives in Indian Point and does not have a job. He hopes new businesses will come soon after meeting Mr. Paulin. Mr. Lyles, who is 26, says, I think it's awesome to have a young mayor. The owner of a local health food store where Mr. Paulin buys fruit drinks is also happy about the young mayor. Kelly Murphy says, his age doesn't bother me. I know he's excited, and I feel when people get around him, we feel excited again. We've lost that for many years in this town. Mr. Paulin began participating in city politics when he was 10 years old. At that time, he urged town officials to put in signs urging drivers to be aware of pedestrians, people crossing the street on foot. Mr. Paulin succeeded. Since then, he says, he has been involved in the town government. As mayor, Mr. Paulin earns only $6,000 a year. In comparison, most U.S. legislators make an average salary of about $40,000 a year. Mr. Paulin lives at home and takes college classes online. His mother, Wendy Paulin, says her son accepts challenges and works on problems until he has a solution. Voters in small towns across the U.S. have elected several other 18- and 19-year-old leaders. But people in Dorset, Minnesota, set the record for a town's youngest mayor. Only about 25 people live in Dorset. Each year, they put all the residents' names in a hat and blindly select someone. In 2012, they chose Bobby Tufts to be their top official. Bobby was 3 years old. I'm Jonathan Evans.
If you want to learn and improve your American English skills, you have come to the right place. This is VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Civics and citizenship education is practiced around the world with at least one common goal. Educators in each country want young people to understand their country's political system. But an international survey in 2009 reported that civics education does not always have the goal of encouraging students to take an active part in their communities. The International Civic and Citizenship Education Study is sponsored by an independent group, the International Association for the Evaluation of Educational Achievement, IEA. The study also found that internationally, students had the highest levels of trust for schools, but the lowest levels of trust for political parties. A large majority of students plan to vote in national elections. Fewer plan to be more politically active as adults by joining a political party or running for office. According to the IEA survey, an important result of increased knowledge about government was that students with this knowledge do not accept authoritarian government. They do not accept corruption or breaking the law either.
In the United States, active participation in civic life is one of the main goals of civic education. The Center for Civic Education, based in California, is one of the nonprofit organizations helping teachers and students meet that goal. The center works with a network of 50 state programs to promote teaching and learning about the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. It also shows students how they can take an active role in their government. Using a textbook and e-book series called We the People, the Citizen, and the Constitution, high school students all over the country learn about the U.S. government. We the People is one of several programs to encourage civic learning in the United States. Another is CIRCLE, the Center for Information on Civic Learning and Engagement. CIRCLE has studied trends in youth voting and on how civics is taught in the U.S. Based on a 2013 survey of government and civics teachers, CIRCLE recommends giving more resources and professional development to these teachers. Robert Peck agrees.
Our professional development as teachers is really important. It allows us to get excited about our curriculum again, take advantage of what's out there. This program's available to everybody. It's supported across the country, and so to me, We the People is the one that gets people excited about civics.
Georgetown University professor Diana Owen studied the students of teachers who received the We the People professional development. A report on the research, published in May 2015, shows that students in those classes have significantly greater knowledge than students in other civics classes of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, political parties and election, and the relation between race and politics. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thank you. This is Mary Tillotson.
And this is Steve Ember with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Today, we tell about the administration of the 38th President of the United States, Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford was sworn in as president on August 9, 1974. The day before, President Richard Nixon had announced that he would resign. If he had not resigned, he probably would have been removed from office. A congressional investigation had found evidence that Nixon violated the constitutional rights of the American people during the Watergate case. The new president spoke about Watergate and what it meant to America on the day he was sworn in.
Our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate.
Gerald Ford became the only president in American history to serve as vice president and president without being elected. Richard Nixon nominated him for vice president in October 1973. That was when Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, resigned. When Nixon himself resigned, Ford became president. Ford was a longtime congressman from the state of Michigan. He was well-liked. He had been a good student and a good athlete. He studied economics and political science at the University of Michigan. Then he studied law at Yale University. During World War II, he served as a Navy officer in the Pacific Battle Area.
After the war, Ford entered politics. He was a member of the Republican Party. He was first elected to Congress in 1948. He won re-election 12 times. Other Republican members of the House of Representatives elected him minority leader during the presidential administration of Democrat Lyndon Johnson. Ford was still minority leader when Republican Richard Nixon was elected president in 1968. In his leadership position, he helped win approval of a number of Nixon's proposals. He became known for his strong loyalty to the president. It was no surprise, then, that Nixon named Ford vice president.
Gerald Ford became president suddenly. Almost as suddenly, he had to decide what to do about former President Nixon. After Nixon left office, he could have been charged with crimes for his part in the Watergate case. Instead, 1 month after Nixon resigned, President Ford settled the question. He pardoned Nixon of any crimes for which he might have been responsible. The pardon made many Americans angry. Some believed Nixon should have been put on trial. They thought he might have answered more questions about Watergate if he had not been pardoned. The new president did what he thought was right. He said he pardoned Nixon to end divisions in the country. For a while, however, his action seemed to increase the divisions.
Anger about the pardon was still strong when President Ford took another highly disputed action. He pardoned the men who illegally escaped military service in the Vietnam War. Most were not sent to prison. Instead, they were permitted to perform work for their communities. Many of the men did not accept the president's offer, however. They remained in hiding in the United States, or they remained in other countries where they had fled. President Ford received much better public support when he asked Congress to control and limit the activities of the nation's intelligence agencies. He hoped this would prevent future administrations from interfering with the constitutional rights of citizens.
Other problems also caused trouble for President Ford. As vice president, he had described inflation as America's public enemy number one. He proposed several measures to fight it. As president, he was forced to cancel some of these measures because there was an economic recession. During the recession, inflation decreased, but fewer Americans had jobs. Unemployment in 1975 was at its highest rate since the Great Economic Depression of the 1930s.
In foreign policy, Ford usually took the advice of Henry Kissinger. Kissinger served as President Nixon's assistant for national security and as Secretary of State. He kept those jobs under President Ford. Kissinger won much praise for his service to Richard Nixon, yet he received much criticism, too. He was accused of interfering with civil liberties in the name of national security, and he was accused of supporting the overthrow of the leftist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. Still, President Ford was pleased that Kissinger would remain in the administration. Even Kissinger's worst critics admitted that he was an excellent negotiator.
At the time Ford became president, America's situation in the world was generally hopeful. Former President Nixon and Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev had signed two agreements to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. Also, relations with China were less tense than before. However, American policy in parts of Southeast Asia had failed completely.
American involvement in the Vietnam War officially ended the year before Ford became president. But fighting continued between South Vietnam and communist forces from North Vietnam. The peace agreement signed by the United States and North Vietnam in 1973 left South Vietnam to defend itself. By 1975, it became clear that South Vietnamese forces were in danger of defeat. President Ford tried to prevent a total communist takeover of the South. He asked Congress to approve $700 million in military aid for South Vietnam. The American people, however, were tired of paying for the war. Their representatives in Congress said no.
What happened in Vietnam was like a bad dream. Communist forces moved into Saigon, capital of the South. Ford ordered the rescue of American citizens and of Vietnamese who had supported American efforts. Few who saw people trying to escape Saigon will ever forget the day. It was April 30th, 1975. Terrified Vietnamese were screaming for help at the American embassy. Everyone was pushing, trying to escape. Some who reached the embassy's roof passed their children forward. At least, they hoped, they could get the children to safety on American military helicopters. Others held on to the helicopters from the outside as the overloaded aircraft tried to take off.
The Ford administration also faced trouble in the Middle East. Israel and an alliance of Arab nations had fought two wars in about 10 years. After the War of 1973, Henry Kissinger led negotiations to settle some issues. Israel agreed to give up some of the territory it had seized during the fighting. In return, the United States made a promise. It would not recognize or deal with the Palestine Liberation Organization as long as the PLO failed to meet certain conditions. In September 1975, Israel and Egypt signed a ceasefire agreement. They also agreed to permit American civilians to act as observers along the ceasefire lines. Henry Kissinger received widespread praise for his peacemaking efforts. Yet the situation in the Middle East remained tense.
The Ford administration could not fix all the problems of the world. Still, as the presidential election campaign of 1976 began, things seemed better. The United States was not fighting any wars. Unemployment was high, but inflation had improved a little. Most important, Gerald Ford had led the country through the difficult days after Watergate. The election will be our story next time.
This program of The Making of a Nation was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Cynthia Kirk. Our audio engineer was Keith Holmes. This is Mary Tillotson.
And this is Steve Ember. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States.